From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the state Senate approves an auto insurance reform plan. We'll bring you the latest from Lansing. Plus, Mustafa Ali's lifelong battle for environmental justice and why he left the Trump EPA.
I knew they were going to end up making more people sick if this stuff was able to move forward. And I also knew that eventually people would lose their lives.
The Rouge River finally healing after decades of abuse.
During the winter of 1948, there was so much oil, millions of gallons was dumping into the Rouge annually.
And a comic book series brings us the complete history of pinball.
It's something that never really gets old because you always want to play again and see what happens with that crazy ball movement.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Senate has been busy today fast-tracking a new auto insurance reform plan. They're seeking a way to reduce premiums that are unaffordable by federal standards in 97% of Michigan zip codes, according to a recent U of M analysis. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News has been covering the action in Lansing. Jonathan, the Senate Insurance Committee approved the new plan this morning and passed the full Senate early this afternoon. So what are the major changes?
Yeah, so really the biggest change here is that this proposal would end the state's longstanding guarantee that auto insurance policies include lifetime unlimited medical benefits for injured motorists. Currently, Michigan is the only state in the country that requires that sort of lifetime coverage. Supporters of the current system say it makes Michigan's, you know, insurance law the best in the country and helps, you know, care for folks who are saddled with debilitating injuries that can cost huge amounts of money over their lifetime to care for. Critics, though, say that is the primary cost driver that is leading to high rates in Michigan. The plan would also mandate lower reimbursement rates for hospitals and other medical providers. It would create what's called a fee schedule, equivalent basically to costs right now for workers' comp. In other words, the rate that hospitals currently charge patients who are paying through their workers' compensation, they charge those same rates to auto insurers.
So, Jonathan, what would this bill mean for consumers in terms of the coverage they might be able to get?
Well, insurers could still offer policies with unlimited medical benefits if they chose to, but they'd be unlikely to do so because the state is essentially going to be ending a reinsurance program that currently reimburses insurers for the most expensive claims. So the most likely options that motorists are going to have available under this legislation would be one plan that would have as little as $50,000 in personal injury protection, but also cover up to $200,000 of emergency room care. Another option would include up to $250,000 of personal injury protection. And then under a third option, motorists who actually already have health insurance that would cover medical benefits in an auto accident could actually waive personal injury protection altogether and instead just rely on their insurer, whether that be a public or private health plan.
And so I suppose it's hard to say how much someone could see their rates reduced because it would depend on their menu of choices.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the bill's sponsor estimates, you know, most folks could save anywhere between 15% and 46%. Now, that's just based on, you know, how much that personal injury protection component currently, you know, makes up your auto insurance bill. It's not the whole bill, of course. There's several other things you pay for through car insurance as well. So that's his estimate. There's no real independent outside estimates at this point. As you noted, this plan was just unveiled this morning and then flew through committee and the floor. So I imagine, you know, third party or independent groups might dive into this and try and assess those potential savings themselves. But for now, all we have to go on is the word of the sponsoring senator. That said, maybe you want to talk about this a little bit. Most Democrats voted against this plan because it doesn't guarantee cost savings. They wanted mandates in there to say explicitly that insurers would have to reduce rates by a certain amount, but that is not included in this plan.
And what's the other Democratic objections?
Well, there were several, but another big one is the fact that this plan doesn't prohibit insurers from using non-driving factors to set rates. So non-driving factors include things like zip codes, for instance. And it's, you know, insurers are currently allowed to consider those non-driving factors when they set rates. And critics say, you know, that contributes to sky-high rates in cities like Detroit. Michigan is known for having some of the highest auto insurance premiums in the country. But a large part of that is the fact that Detroit is far and away the most expensive city in the nation. So, you know, Democrats wanted to sort of level the playing field to prohibit insurers from using those sorts of factors. Now, the plan approved today did bar insurers, or at least attempt to bar insurers, from using gender as a factor to set rates. But the Republican majority rejected Democratic amendments that would have gone further to prohibit things such as zip codes, like I mentioned, and credit scores and so on that insurers also currently can use to set rates.
And in our last few seconds, what's happening in the House? What kind of reception might this Senate plan get in the House?
Well, certainly the leaders in both chambers have been discussing this for a while, and just like the Senate that has held hearings on potential solutions, the House has been doing so as well. I just talked to a spokesman over in the House, and he said, you know, they're going to look at the Senate's proposal, and as he put it, use those suggestions and others to build the best plan possible for Michigan families. So to me, that suggests they're probably considering some changes to this, but are certainly going to consider it moving forward. Under the state rules, there's a what's called a five-day rule, so the House cannot take up this proposal this week, so they'll have at least 1 week to consider what they want to do, and potentially much longer if they choose.
The bill is 79 pages long, and the Republicans unveiled it less than an hour before the committee voted. How do they respond to pushback that no one got enough time to read what was in the bill?
Yeah, well, I asked several lawmakers about that very fact, and they basically said, you know, we've been debating these concepts for years. You know, they'll argue things like a fee schedule for hospitals and coverage, medical coverage options have been considered by the legislature before. That said, you know, this particular suite of proposals, this particular bill, as you mentioned, had not been given a lot of time. Democrats suggested that, you know, most people who are forced to vote for it today have not actually read what they voted on. But, you know, again, Republicans say these aren't new ideas. It's just a new combination of them. And they wanted to move quickly. You know, the old saying in the legislature is if you have the votes, you generally try and move it as quickly as possible so things don't change. And that seemed to be the operating instructions for the Senate Republicans today.
Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News, thanks so much for covering this for us.
All right. Thank you.
The Brain Injury Association of Michigan has been fighting to maintain Michigan's auto no-fault system. Tom Constand is president and CEO. Tom, what are your thoughts of the bill that came out of the state Senate today?
Well, unfortunately, it does nothing to guarantee rate reduction. To me, it's very one-sided. It's kind of a giveaway to the auto insurance industry. Michigan residents have spoken out time and again. They're desperate for real relief. And instead, we've got this. It does nothing to prohibit insurance industry's discriminatory practice of rate setting based on non-driving rating factors, which has been talked about a lot. It doesn't move us from what they call a file-in-use system, that's where insurance companies can set the rates with little or no oversight, to a prior approval system, which has worked in other states, California as an example. And there was much discussion of that over the last couple of weeks. It doesn't include any kind of a fair and balanced fraud authority. And we've seen this before. It's likely a tax increase on all Michigan residents because it's going to shift the costs onto the back of state Medicaid. And that's happened in other states. So very disappointed, very disappointed.
And the fact that it was a 79-page bill unveiled less than an hour before the committee voted and just a few hours before the full Senate voted, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that people's minds were made up before this was pushed through. You know, I understand people's desire and their zeal for reform, but if you're going to evaluate proper reform, you've got to go through the proper steps. You've got to evaluate this like a business would evaluate it and take a look at all of the problems that are inherent in no fault and address those. And it doesn't appear that they did that.
Well, we know people want relief in their car insurance rates. They're begging for that, or they're going without because they can't afford it. So how do we balance that reality with the need to care for people who suffer catastrophic injuries in auto accidents? If not this bill that passed the Senate, what's the way forward here in your view?
The way forward, I think, is consumer protection, and that's what's lacking in this bill. Consumer protection in the form of, as we talked about earlier, the fact that the insurance industry has continued to allow the use of non-driving rating factors being used in setting your premiums. The fact that there's no rate regulation at all over the insurance industry in the state of Michigan. There are none of these consumer protection initiatives that could be embedded into the new no-fault law that would help protect us from these practices. We've talked about in the past of the need for a fee schedule. We understand that a fee schedule offers a degree of predictability for insurance companies, and that makes sense. There's no fee schedule in this bill. Instead, it's relying on the insurance industry to willingly lower their rates if they implement all of this.
Well, my understanding is the proposal does create a fee schedule for the providers, can only charge insurers at the rates mandated under workers' compensation.
Well, I've not seen that. Again, we just got it this morning, I think, when everybody else got it.
But, right. It does create a fee schedule that's basically what they can charge under workers' comp.
Well, that's one step out of 10. Unfortunately, the 9 others obviously weren't taken. It's disappointing, very disappointing.
The State House is going to take up this bill and consider it. What is your message to those lawmakers?
Well, we would encourage members of the State House to look at the tenets of a fair and affordable and sustainable package that we endorsed last year, and many elements of that are being carried forward this year, and we hope that they implement that. Again, consumer protection. Some type of rate regulation over the insurance industry, the elimination of the use of non-driving rating factors, probably the most blatant civil rights infringement that there is out there, especially in the area of Detroit. Nothing to protect consumers, and that's what we encourage the House to incorporate in their revisions or maybe their new bill.
Tom Constant, Brain Injury Association of Michigan's president and CEO. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, we meet the authors of a new comic book dedicated to pinball.
This is such an incredibly deep and rich hobby. I mean, you can appreciate it in any number of ways. It's just a seemingly endless source of discovery and place to explore.
That is in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for some music from West Michigan as we say hello again to John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com. And John, you've presented us with such a long list of exciting creative artists through the years. And by golly, this time around is no exception. You've got three terrific and different sounding groups for us, starting with Graham Parsons and his band, The Go-Rounds. Now, they're based in Kalamazoo.
Yes, and I can literally think of no other band, locally or national, that sounds quite like the Go-Rounds. Graham Parsons is somewhat charismatic, somewhat enigmatic. He uses a lot of dreamy, reverb-laden, and twangy sort of indie rock elements in his music. He uses two microphones during his live shows so that he can sort of add effects on one of the microphones, and it really makes for a very interesting atmospheric sound. And I think the latest album pushes the envelope of creativity even farther down the road. You know, they recorded this with producer Ben Cohen and recorded the album at Chris Colte's High Bias Studios in Detroit, and I really think that it takes another step, sort of sometimes experimental and sometimes very catchy.
Well, let's take a listen to the track from their newest album. This title is Why Does It Feel So Bad?
One in the morning, cold at night, tired of losing, sleep that I never had. Wonder where you are, wonder where I. My body breaks down, and I'm out of the night, into the twilight.
Tell us who's in this group and how they came together. They've been together quite a while, haven't they?
They have indeed. It's Whatever You May Be is the name of the new album, and it's interesting. They actually started out as a much bigger ensemble, and now they tour as a four-piece band, and they're actually touring the United States in May behind this new album. They're going to be back at the end of the month to headline the Bus Benefit, which is hosted by Buses by the Beach at Camp Blodgett along Lake Michigan, south of Grand Haven on May 25. This is a very unique festival, kind of kicks off the season. They play Shorts Brewing in Bel Air on June 1, and the River Scene Music Festival in Bay City on June 8, and then, interestingly, Graham Parsons also hosts his own music festival. He's been doing this for many years on the farm where he grew up. It's in the Keweenaw Peninsula, and the Upper Peninsula takes place July 26th through 28th. Another opportunity to see some great regional bands as well as the go-rounds.
And I actually was so intrigued by Why Does It Feel So Bad that I went to their website, to the go-rounds website. They're busy, busy. They're going to be all over the country and all around Michigan, a lot of other dates besides these ones.
Absolutely. They really deserve a bigger audience, I think, and they're starting to prove that.
Next, we have a roots rock band from Grand Rapids.
Yeah, Jack Droppers and the Best Intentions. I think I may have mentioned them in a previous episode down the road, but this is their brand new album called Bottled Up Like a Neon Light. It's their third studio album, and they have really been getting more and more, as I put it, more of a steady and brisk wind in their billowing sails over the past year. They've been getting more attention. They just came back from South by Southwest, and they'll be performing a bunch of shows here later this month. But Jack Droppers has a unique, sort of uber-passionate, very mesmerizing sort of roots rock flavor to his music, inspired by, you know, people like Bruce Springsteen and a lot of others. And the band, which includes Laura Hobson, Devin Sullivan, James Kessel, Garrett Steer, and Joshua Halicki, really have started to sort of, you know, maybe spread their wings a little bit with this third album. And it's a lot of fun to hear that with a band like this that is sort of absorbing sort of a more classic sound.
Let's take a listen. This is Hey Maria from this third studio album from Jack Droppers and the Best Intentions.
They got Jungle Land on the jukebox. There's a blue ribbon in your hand. And the whole room is moving together like a high school marching band. Joe puts his arm around Maria as he stands to give a toast. Here's to the countries that couldn't love us, and to the land we love the most. And the whole thing seems a little bit contrived as someone shouts out from the right.
I hear some Springsteen. I dare say I even feel like I hear a little bit from the way Bradley Cooper sang and the band that was behind him in Star Is Born. There was just kind of that country rock vibe that I really, really like.
Hadn't heard that before, but I think he'd probably like to hear that.
There you go. And now we have a band that's kind of the alternate gig for its front man.
Yeah, Matt Tenclay is one of those guys that works behind the scenes under the radar. He's very well known, well regarded in Grand Rapids as a kind of a producer and an engineer. He owns Amberlit Audio Studios here in Grand Rapids. And so he's got this in-demand sound honcho flavor to what he does, especially with psychedelic rock bands in this area. But like a lot of producers who also happen to be musicians and songwriters, I think his own music kind of gets overlooked and underappreciated. I kind of look at him kind of like T-Bone Burnett, you know, who's this incredibly well-known, nationally known producer who does some great work with all of these other bands, but then his own solo work. I mean, some of T-Bone's solo work is some of the best stuff you'll ever want to hear. And I sort of feel the same way about Matt Tenclay in the regional sense. He refers to his own music as sort of poignant, yet hazy and droney, dark, psychedelic pop. And it really is kind of interesting stuff, and he really is creating some fetching material that I really appreciate.
Well, I know you've chosen the title track from the band's new album, so let's take a listen to The Sun Comes Up, The Sun Goes Down. So So with all the producing and engineering he does at his studio, is there a lot of time for Matt to do shows with the Howers?
He doesn't do a lot of shows with his own band, but he does borrow members from other bands for his projects, including Pat Whelan and Adam Cavanaugh from the very well-known group around here called Lazy Genius, Sean Stearns from Coffin Problem, and Dan Fisher, who plays in a zillion bands here in the Grand Rapids area, including I Believe in Julio and Shane Tripp and with Fiona Dickinson. But he is going to be performing an album release show with the Howlers on May 18th. It's going to take place at the Pyramid Scheme in Grand Rapids, and Blanca Luz, which also has a new album to debut, and Flushed are also going to be playing at that show.
It's lots of fun. So just to recap, out of Grand Rapids, we heard the Howlers, and we heard Jack Droppers and the Best Intentions. And then based in Kalamazoo, we heard Graham Parsons' band, the Go-Rounds. And as always, you'll find reviews, news, show dates, and lots more for these and other West Michigan artists. Just go to localspins.com, published and edited by John Sinkovich. Always great exploring music with you, John. Thank you.
Thanks, and have a fabulous May.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The very earliest origins of pinball machines go back to 1871. And certainly by the early 20th century, pinball machines as we know them were being played with gusto here in the United States. And in the high-tech world of 2019, there are still avid pinball fans, including my next two guests. This is a story first reported by R.J. Wolcott for the Lansing State Journal, so a hat tip to R.J. MSU art professor Ryan Claytor and podcast host Nick Baldridge met and bonded over their mutual love of pinball machines, and they poured the love into a new 64-page comic book called Coin-Op Carnival, Electrifying Tales of Mechanical Contraptions. Ryan loves pinball, and he loves and draws comic books. Nick hosts For Amusement Only, the Electromagnetic Games and Bingo Pinball podcast. And they're talking up their book and all things pinball, touring around 10 states, including Michigan, but they are taking time to be with us now. Welcome, guys. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us, yes.
That was quite the introduction. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Ryan, I want to start with you. How far back do you go, first with pinball machines and then comic books?
So as I was growing up, in very early age, 3, 4, 5 years old, my dad had a pinball machine or two in our basement, and he still does even today. But growing up, I played mostly Flash Gordon and a Mr. and Mrs. Pac-Man pinball machine. And then I sort of forgot about pinball for about 20 years or so until getting back into it probably a little over half a dozen years ago. And in terms of comics, I was kind of a reluctant reader when I was young, and I sort of found my way into an appreciation of reading through comics and started out with Disney comics, sort of gravitating toward the Duck books like Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge. And then as I grew up a little bit, I started appreciating satire more, and I started reading this book called Gru the Wanderer by Sergio Aragonés. He's a cartoonist who's been drawing for Mad Magazine for well over 50 years, and he's just the best cartoonist in the world as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, my. And I know it's taken root in you so much, the fact that you're the director of the MSU Comics Forum, and you've produced lots of comics, sharing your life really through comic books. And what about you, Nick? When did you discover pinball machines, and what was it about them that grabbed you?
Well, my parents were avid pinball players, and from a young age, we would go to arcades and play different games. They introduced me to pinball. I recall at 4 years old, standing on a crate playing a game, and I've loved it ever since.
Boy, never let it be said that parents can't influence the things their kids love when they, you know, grow up.
That's right.
And I know that you've got a podcast that digs into things like electromagnetic games and pinball. But how did the two of you meet?
So Ryan and I met over the internet and through the podcast, actually. He had picked up a game that he wanted to fix, and my podcast is of a very technical nature and discusses how to repair games and bring them back to life. So he reached out to me and asked if I had any suggestions on how to get the thing going, and over several chats, he got his game working. So our friendship kind of blossomed from there, and we started talking about more than just pinball, believe it or not. And we decided to go on a vacation together, our families. Having never met in person, this is kind of a sketchy thing, but
it's a leap of faith.
It turned out very well, and our families got along famously. So
And now this friendship has led the two of you to collaborate and produce Coin-Op Carnival. Who contributed what, Ryan?
Well, both Nick and I wrote about half of the issue, and then I illustrated the entire thing. But I really want to push Nick's involvement in this, because even as I'm drawing, I'm sending them to Nick, and we're both very interested in the history of the coin-operated amusement industry, and he would see things that I might not in terms of historical accuracy and point them out. So I'm really excited and confident about the product that we have in front of us today.
And what do you cover? Because my understanding is this is the first of a series of books that you're planning to do, Nick?
That's correct. So we are covering electromechanical games. They begin in the 1930s, about 1934, and go up to about 1978. So there's a lot of ground to cover, but the primary focus of each issue is an interview with an electromechanical pinball designer. And we have the interviews for the first four issues sealed up and ready to go. And for the first issue, we interviewed the oldest living pinball designer, Wayne Nyans. He's also one of the most prolific, if not the most prolific. So very excited to have that out in the world now.
And who would you say is the audience for this book, Ryan?
So we're really trying to split our audience with this book. We want to have historically accurate information and kind of dig deep into the pinball and electromechanical amusement industry such that people deep down the rabbit hole, like Nick and I, can appreciate it. But at the same time, we want this to be accessible to newcomers. So we have segments like Nick's EM Tech Explained segment, which walk people through how to start working on these games. And I even handed a copy of this to my mom, who otherwise does not care at all about pinball. And after reading this interview with Wayne Nyans, she said, I loved that interview because he covers a lot more than just his time in the coin-op industry. You know, he talks about growing up in Chicago in the 1930s during the Depression and going off to the war and a lot of stuff that he hasn't really covered in other interviews before. So we're really excited to put this out.
And how did you kind of make choices in design and aesthetic of your illustrations?
Well, it was really important for me to have this book be wholly and completely illustrated. There is not a photograph in the entire book. Every single page has full-color illustrations by me. Some of those pages are full-blown comics. In fact, about 20% of the book are pages of comics. And so I really wanted this to have a hand-drawn, organic, kind of personal feel to it. And because of that, I've even gone so far as to create a hand-drawn font out of my own handwriting so that it looks like the entire thing was handcrafted by someone.
Boy, oh boy. And what did you think as you saw this work coming at you, Nick? You guys are writing things and then this artist is putting his talents to it and sending it back. What did that feel like to see that kind of come to life?
Oh, it was incredible. It always is. Ryan is a fantastic artist and really captures the spirit of whatever he is illustrating. And I've been lucky enough to see behind the scenes on some of his work before this. And I knew what kind of amazing work he could produce. And I've been a client of his as well. He's illustrated some things for me previously. So he is, I can't say enough about how amazing he is and how amazing this was to see come to life.
And you're on tour. You're kind of getting the book out there and meeting the pinball community. Ryan, what's this tour looking like?
So we're trying to hit, again, a number of different audiences, both pinball shows and also comic conventions and traditional bookstores. So we really want to let a wide swath of people know about this because we believe that we're, you know, positioning this in such a way where it can be appreciated by multiple audiences. So we have about 16 stops in 10 different states across the nation. We're really trying to hit all corners. So we're really doing the best that two working dads can do to get the word out about this book.
And Nick, what has been the response of the pinball community or to really the world at large to the book? How's it doing?
It's doing very well. It's been very humbling and overwhelming, honestly. The response has been great, and people really enjoy the product, which is exactly what we wanted. So it's been very gratifying to see people get this in their hands and tell us what a wonderful book it is.
Do you feel like maybe you're growing a new generation of pinball fans?
I absolutely hope so.
What's the thing you love most about playing pinball? Nick, I'll start with you. What do you love most about pinball?
The thing that I love most is that this is a kinetic game. It is not something that is predetermined like a video game. So every game is completely different. And it's something that never really gets old, never grows tiresome, because you always want to play again and see what happens with that crazy ball movement. So it's a lot of fun.
Ryan?
For me, it's the fact that this is such an incredibly deep and rich hobby. I mean, you can appreciate it in any number of ways, from playing the game to competing in tournaments to appreciating the artwork or the mechanics or the electronics or fixing them or the history. It's just a seemingly endless source of discovery and place to explore. So I feel like I could be in this for the rest of my life and still not discover everything I want to know about the industry.
Well, you can find out more about the book and this very busy tour schedule by going to coinopcarnival.com. MSU art professor Ryan Claytor and podcast host Nick Baldridge, their new 64-page comic book, the first of a series called Coinop Carnival, Electrifying Tales of Mechanical Contraptions. Thanks for sharing your passion with us.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, we talk with a former EPA official who's spent more than two decades building the agency's Office of Environmental Justice. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If it seems like you can hardly go anywhere in Wayne, Oakland, or Washtenaw counties without bumping into the Rouge River, you're not entirely wrong. The Rouge has 126 river miles, not to mention many tributaries. And much of the Rouge River watershed is urban, with over 1.35 million people living in the watershed. And that means a tough history of pollution. And that's exactly why the Friends of the Rouge was founded in 1986, to clean up and to protect this natural resource so important to Southeast Michigan. Last Thursday, I spoke with the executive director of Friends of the Rouge, Marie McCormick. She was part of our Stateside show in Dearborn. Here's our conversation. Marie McCormick, so good to have you with us here.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
I think it's really true. I'm always either walking on a path and there's some of the Rouge, or you're driving by. Certainly here in Dearborn, it's hard to miss the Rouge. Give us a little bit of an overview of the Rouge. Where is its origin, and how large is this watershed?
Well, it's a 467-square-mile watershed. We have 48 communities in our watershed. It is a very dynamic watershed with many different people. I think that the watershed can be characterized as highly urbanized. About 50% is urbanized. In Wayne County alone, we only have about 10% of our wetlands left.
Hmm. And when you think about, you know, the history of the Rouge, before the Europeans showed up, do we know what the native tribes called this river?
You know, I looked up the name of the Native American people and the words that they used to describe the river, but I don't feel like I'm the person to say them.
Yeah. What did they translate?
They translate it into Singing Skin River.
Oh, I like that.
Which means the place where they dressed the furs.
Yes.
Along the side of the river.
And so, it was certainly part of their life. And when and how did the river get its European name? Get the name we know now.
Well, the French called the river the Rouge River, which means Red River, and that was from the color of the rushes that the river kind of runs along. And that was back when the river had more rushes along it.
You know, I've heard it called the River Rouge, and I've heard it called the Rouge River. And our Stateside producer, Mike Blank, says when he was growing up downriver, he had a fourth grade teacher who insisted, you have to say the River Rouge. What phrase do you use?
Well, the Friends of Rouge, we call it the Rouge River. Okay. There is a community called River Rouge. Mm-hmm. And so using them kind of together, it makes it a little confusing. We just use River Rouge, or Rouge River. I'm sorry.
I'm even getting
it confused.
Take us through the rise of industrialism. What did factories and production do to this river?
Well, I think there's three really important pieces in the rise of industrialization that I'd like to touch on. One is the channelization of the Rouge River, and that took place both in the 1800s when they basically subdivided the Zug Island from River Rouge, the community. Zug Island is actually part of River Rouge. Second, Henry Ford convinced the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge a lot of the Rouge River all the way up to the Turning Basin so that he could bring his freighters up for his closed-loop industrial system that he used to manufacture automobiles. But also during the wars, he manufactured, you know, different things like the Eagle Bombers. And so we call this area the arsenal of democracy. And it's got to happen somewhere. And it just ends up happening here. So that was back in the early 1900s. When you move up a couple of decades in the 1940s, there were particularly cold winters in 1948. And during the winter of 1948, there was so much oil, millions of gallons, was dumping into the Rouge annually. And that was just normal. That was just kind of what people did. And this particular winter, the water was so cold and the ice had frozen and very few pockets of open water were left. And as some people know, the Detroit River is known for its migratory bird populations. And over 11,000 ducks and geese were killed that winter. Upset sportsmen dug those ducks out, threw them in the back of their truck, and drove them up to Lansing and dropped them on the state capitol lawn. And that was shocking. So that actually helped form the Michigan Natural Resources Commission, which helped with a lot of legislation. Moving forward, two decades later, it was still being polluted. And in 1969, October 9th, 1969, the Rouge River actually caught fire.
All right. So let's talk about, when did serious productive efforts to clean up the river begin?
1972, the Clean Water Act was passed. That's a huge leap for environmentalism across the country and the state, and moving forward even further, because I know we got short on time. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that happen. But in 1986, the Friends of the Rouge was formed. In the 90s, it was the Rouge River Wet Weather Demonstration Project. That was $350 million that the late Congressman John Dingell really helped usher through. That funding provided immense support to making the river much cleaner.
And I know that the goal of the Friends of the Rouge is to achieve a clean, vibrant Rouge River. How far along would you say we are and all of us really together, to reaching that goal?
I think we've done incredible work to date. Right now, we have a viable water trail that we're going to be rolling out in the next year. So people can actually get on the river, canoe and kayak, the Lower Rouge, from Canton all the way down to River Rouge. We have a robust rain garden program. We've seen incredible leaps in diversification of fish species. Several decades ago, we only counted about 6 different varieties or species. Now we're seeing 13, 15 species of fish, hundreds of them, and not just carp and goldfish, but even sensitive species that are really indicators for the health of the water.
Cleanup day is coming, May the 18th. What happens and what do volunteers do? And can you use volunteers?
Oh my gosh, we can use so many volunteers. Rouge Rescue is our annual cleanup. Mm-hmm. To date, we've had over 60,000 volunteers work with us. We normally get around 2,000 to 3,000 each year. And volunteers can do everything from pull trash out of the river, pull invasive species, plant a rain garden, you name it. There's activities for kids, adults, families. We welcome you all.
What has been, finally, the most rewarding thing for you in this work you've done protecting the Rouge?
Well, I grew up in the Rouge at the confluence of the Walled Lake Branch and the Johnson Creek. If anyone knows where that is, you can figure out where I grew up. So it's sort of full circle. I grew up here, I left for a long time, and I wanted to come back and give to my community. And to me, this is the best way I can do it.
Well, thank you very much, Executive Director of Friends of the Rouge, Marie McCormick. Thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Bye-bye.
Drinking water, invasive species, toxic pollution, just some of the challenges facing our water here in the Great Lakes, and the focus of a conference happening this week by Healing Our Waters, Great Lakes Coalition. Mustafa Santiago Ali will deliver the keynote speech at the Detroit conference on Thursday. He's Vice President for Environmental Justice, Climate, and Community Revitalization for the National Wildlife Federation. But before that, Ali was with the EPA for 24 years, where he co-founded the agency's Office of Environmental Justice and worked to fight the impact of pollution on impoverished towns and neighborhoods. He also spent time working for Congressman John Conyers. Mustafa Ali, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let us start by
getting a working definition of environmental justice. It's been your life work. And in your biography for this upcoming conference, it notes your work's grounded in the 17 principles of the environmental justice movement. We can't go all through all 17, but give us a sense of just what environmental justice means to you.
Sure. Environmental justice, you know, if you want sort of the traditional definition, it deals with the disproportionate impact in communities of color and low-income communities and indigenous populations. But what it really means is, you know, that we often place the things that we don't want in our most vulnerable communities. It also deals with having the opportunity to have your voice reflected in the decision-making process, and also making sure that resources are actually going to the communities that need them the most. So, you know, it deals with everything from housing to transportation to environmental issues, public health issues, and jobs, and a little bit more than that. But, you know, when we begin to actually take a holistic look at the impacts, but also the opportunities, then you really understand what environmental justice is all about.
During your career, you've worked on environmental justice in more than 500 communities across the country. Could you give us an example or two of what that work looks like in practice on the ground?
Sure. I mean, and it varies. You know, it could be in a number of communities working on lead-related issues and helping to either, you know, mitigate some of the impacts that are happening. It could be in, you know, areas where people are dealing with coal-fired power plants and helping them to understand those air emissions, the public health impacts on their lives, the various laws that are in place that they can utilize to get engaged in the process and to help make change happen. It could be working, you know, in North Carolina, as I have, on some of the CAFO issues, the certified animal feeding operations. For those who don't know what that means, hog farms, chicken farms, turkey farms, and the impacts that happen to our water quality in those spaces.
And you helped to found the Environmental Justice Office at the EPA in 1992 during the George H.W. Bush presidency. How has the conversation around environmental justice and the EPA's approach to it evolved over the years since then? What have you seen?
Oh, my goodness. That is such an excellent question. You know, when I first started, it was amazing because you literally had folks who were officials who had, you know, a specific responsibility to protect public health and the environment to tell folks from communities that what they were experiencing wasn't real, that they were either making it up or they were over-exaggerating the impacts that were happening. And those were in the early days. And then seeing an evolution slowly start to happen inside the agency and outside, because I also, by the time I was finishing up, also ran 17 federal agencies and departments. But staying with EPA, watching the various sort of training courses be put in place, watching communities building relationships on the inside. Sometimes it took a while. It was really tough. But watching real relationships build throughout the agency, then watching people begin to formalize environmental justice in the agency and a number of the policies and activities, eventually getting to where the integration of environmental justice was happening throughout the agency. And then, of course, the agency, as being a lead, sent a signal to the other federal agencies that they began to also integrate environmental justice. And that's when you start to really get to the holistic approach, because the impacts that are happening in communities, of course, the Environmental Protection Agency plays a role in that, but a number of these other agencies also have a significant role to play in helping these communities to move from surviving to thriving.
A lot of years building all of this and assembling all of this, and you left the EPA in 2017 after 24 years at that agency. Why did you leave?
Yeah, that was a tough one because, you know, I kind of grew up in the agency, so it was a really tough decision. But when I saw some of the things that were being proposed and some of the actions that were moving forward by the new administration, I'd never seen anything like this before. And I knew, because of all the work of being out there in communities, the effects that it was going to have. I knew they were going to end up making more people sick if this stuff was able to move forward. And I also knew that eventually people would lose their lives. So I decided to stand up and try to do it in a respectful manner, to do it in an opportunity for people to, and when I say people, at that time, Scott Pruitt and the president, to really understand the value that environmental justice brought to the process. And in my resignation letter, and some reporters told me that like a million people had read it, I tried to highlight those programs and how critical they were, not just the environmental justice program, but many of the other ones that also played a significant role in these communities. I also tried to help them to understand how resources had been used and how communities had asked for these and played a role in the creation of these, which is really critical. It wasn't bureaucrats thinking up this stuff. These were practitioners on the ground who had worked for years to make sure that just the basics were in place. And we're talking about the basics when we talk about environmental justice. And then I also tied it into real-world examples of how change has happened and why both the programs and the resources were critical in that, so that they would see that there were real opportunities for a new administration to be able to continue to move forward, hopefully in a positive direction. And when I saw some of the things that they were moving forward on and proposing, I knew I couldn't be a part of that because they were moving in a direction that was going to take us backwards and, as I said before, put people's lives in danger.
Where do things stand now with the office, and did they ever fill your position that you know of?
No, they've never filled my position. And it's such a shame also because the office has now been moved. They did not get rid of the office. But what they did do is that they moved the office, which was a national program office, on the same sort of level as the Office of Air and Office of Water, you know, in relationship to the conversations that happened inside the agency. And they've now moved it over into the policy shop a couple levels down so that the voice of the office is muted. And I'll just share this with you also. You know, the importance of the Office of Environmental Justice is that it was very unique, and it was unique in the sense that it came out of a set of recommendations from stakeholders called the Michigan Working Group a number of years ago in the late 80s and the early 90s. So this was probably one of the first times ever in the federal government that the voice of communities played a role in the creation of such a significant entity, even though it was a smaller entity. And it actually gave them a real intersection or an on-ramp, if you will, into what can be a very confusing set of, you know, conversations and, you know, just trying to get into that whole federal bureaucracy and have someone who's there to help walk with you through that and then to allow you to, you know, sort of have the conversations and make the decisions that best represent your communities.
Looking ahead to Thursday, you're the keynote speaker Thursday at the big conference put on by Healing Our Waters, Great Lakes Coalition. It's all centered on environmental justice in the Great Lakes region. What will your message be?
Well, one, as I talk around the country, I'm always helping people to realize that they have power unless they give it away. And that power can play out in lots of different ways. In the civic process, making sure that you are honoring your vote. Never tell anybody who to vote for, but you should be voting for somebody who cares about your communities, and you have to make the decision of whom that is. Also about, you know, some of the real challenges that we have around our water quality. And, you know, we only have so much fresh water, and we should be paying, you know, particular attention and making sure that is being protected, that's being utilized in a proper way, but that it is also affordable. You know, we find that there's this new dynamic that's happening around our country where, one, a lot of folks, because of some of the things that people have been seeing around the country, don't trust our water quality, especially our drinking water. And now a lot of the water is being unaffordable. And then there are all these other dynamics that happen in that space. Unfortunately, sometimes people find themselves in a position where they might actually lose their children because they couldn't pay their water bill, things have been shut off. So all these different dynamics that are happening in relationship to water. So that's something we have to pay attention to. We have to pay attention also to the algae blooms that are popping up now because of climate change and because of some of these practices, agricultural practices. And I know that the Great Lakes have been paying particular attention to that. We also got to make sure that our elected officials understand that we've got this incredible resource there that we should be making sure that we're putting the funding, again, in place to make sure that those who are trying to protect it, those who are regulating, have what they need to be able to move forward on that. And then, of course, you know, with all the changes that are happening because of climate change, we're going to talk about that as well and how those could have some additional impacts on folks who are living in the Great Lakes region.
A longtime fighter for environmental justice with years at the EPA and now with the National Wildlife Federation. Mustafa Ali, thank you so much for speaking with us and spending time with us.
Oh, thank you for the incredible work you guys do, and thank you for having me.
And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.